Okay, welcome to another episode of Just Another Bozo on the Bus. Welcome, Bozo. That's what I call my listeners.
I love it.
Because we are all Bozos on the bus.
That really does resonate with me. I feel like I'm at home here.
Well, and that's what we want. Okay. Welcome. I'm excited to invite Mike Haas, who is a friend and a colleague and has been doing some amazing work in the recovery and healing community here in Utah. We will get into talking a bit about, maybe quite a bit about Red Barn. I used to always say Red Barn Farms, but now I'm adjusting to Academy. So.
Thank you. We appreciate that. And so does the industry.
You're I guess I hadn't thought about it from that perspective, but that makes sense, right? The industry. But it is a farm, too, of course. I mean,
yeah, it is a working farm, and that's where we teach our life skills. So, obviously, an important component of the work we do.
Yeah. And the idea, and though I don't want to go into it right now, but just the idea of having a working farm be part of teaching life skills just sounds such an incredible, wholesome way to approach teaching people how to learn to take care of themselves by taking care of something else. So. Right. Anyway, we'll get there. But Mike, thanks so much. I appreciate you being here today. And let's start off with telling a little bit about yourself and your story and kind of how you got here. You know,
I'd be happy to. Yeah. First off, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk a little bit about my favorite topic, which is me, and sharing a little experience, strength, and hope. I think, you know, I'm feeling right now very, very blessed to be here where I'm at. And coincidentally, it's Recovery Day 2018 here in Salt Lake City, Utah. And
Yes, it is. Down at the Galvin Center.
Center. It's very well attended and a lot of good friends, a lot of good memories, I would say, and some tough memories as well, because there's some of our friends that are no longer with us.
That's true.
Today, and they're down there wearing buttons, and obviously that resonates and hits close to home and is an important part of my story.
That's true. Yes.
So to start off, my name is Mike Haas. I'm 42 years old. I was born in Farmington, Utah, so I'm a local resident here in Utah. Grew up in a little town called Centerville that I come from a wonderful family. There were five boys, one sister, so six total. And, you know, I grew up in a very, very loving home. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. Mm-hmm. We were part of the predominant religion here in Utah. And as a result of that, a lot of my life was planned out from the very beginning. And it's an important part of my story because...
Or at least the expectation of what your life was supposed to look like, right?
Yeah, the expectations and living under what I call the burden of potential. You know, great potential.
It's a good way to put it.
And so there was a lot of potential, you know, early on and a lot of pressure that I felt. And, you know, I like to share this part of my story because, you know, my earliest memories of childhood... I was just a youngster, probably 5 or 6 years old, and I remember, you know, growing up and really not fitting in. I remember looking at some pictures the other day. It was the first day of kindergarten, and I kind of had this sad look on my face. I'm standing there with my brother. He's 13 months older than I am, and he's got this big smile, and he's standing up straight. And, you know, I'm standing there kind of dejected with my shoulders kind of hunched over, And my earliest memories of childhood were that I wasn't very strong. I wasn't very good looking. I was a little overweight. I felt very, very insecure. Hmm. And,
you'd already created a whole series of beliefs about yourself and what wasn't okay and what wasn't working.
Absolutely. And so as I, got involved in, scouting, I got involved in sports, I got involved in, school activities, I always kind of felt like I was on the outside. And so I was just trying to catch up and trying to keep up with my friends. And, you know, I was a late bloomer in life. I didn't hit puberty till later on in life. And so I remember feeling a little insecure about myself because I was the youngest of my class.
What's later? What are you?
So, you know, for me, fast forward a little bit to, you know, I remember going to junior high and, you know, it was required for us to take showers together with the other guys. And I didn't want to shower because, you know, I hadn't hit puberty yet. And so I felt a little bit awkward. And then that theme and that kind of undertone carried through high school. Mm-hmm. So when I say late bloomer, I remember, you know, 19, 20 years old before I had to start shaving or, you know, started to actually hit my growth spurt.
Sure.
And so, you know, the first time, and I think it's important for the listeners to understand, but the first time that I was introduced to alcohol and or drugs, I was a junior in high school. And I remember like it was yesterday because it had such a huge impact on my life and is a big part of my story. We were there with some friends and, you know, a lot of my friends were athletes and kind of the popular guys. And, you know, they passed around and my first drink was one part Everclear, one part Sunny Delight. And I remember thinking...
That sounds like a very local drink too, by the way.
Right, right. Yeah, no. it fit in well with this community.
Can I ask you real quick, where within your siblings you are?
Uh-huh. That's a good question. Yeah. So I'm the second oldest.
The second to the oldest.
Yeah. Okay. I have an older brother that's a year older than I am. Mm-hmm. So he's 13 months older. David is his name. And then I've got a younger sister that's a couple years younger than me, Emily.
Okay.
And then CJ, Dustin, and Taylor. And so there's five boys and one girl in the family.
The reason why I asked that is you were going to start telling the story about when you, you know, first got introduced to drugs and alcohol. That I was going to ask, you know, was there anyone else in your family? But your brother and you were so close in age that I'm going to guess that there weren't any family issues at that point.
No, no. I mean, I wish I had some good excuse. I wish I could say that, you know, I was molested or, you know, got beat up or something like that. But I really came from a very, very loving family, very, very supportive, had every opportunity in the world. I mean, my biggest really rejection in my family was I remember coming home from high school one day and I had 1 A- on my report card. And, you know, that's where that potential comes in because I remember my dad saying to me, Mike, you know, what happened here? Instead of focusing on maybe the positive, it was more of, you know, why did you fall short here?
Sure.
I never felt like I could live up.
You're living up. Well, shame has many different sources. It has many, it's instigated it in many different ways throughout our life. So it can happen just because it can be baked into the system already that if there's expectation of a certain level of potential,
right?
That already, if I'm not reaching those levels that are expected of me, even if they're not always, you know, verbally, you know, repeated over and over again, I can still internalize that something's wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
But see, and then as I think back on that, I was thinking to myself the other day, I don't remember holding back. I don't remember, you know, not giving it my all. And so that's the paradox for me was that I felt like I was giving it my all, but I was always behind the eight ball. I just couldn't quite impress the most important person in my life at the time, which was my father.
Okay.
So it was never good enough.
Right.
And so as I moved through junior high and high school is where I had my first experience with a mind-altering substance. As I mentioned, with drinking alcohol, I remember when that Everclear hit my gut, all my fears went away.
Oh.
All of a sudden, I'm taller. I'm a little better looking. I could go talk to girls. You know, we talk about, you know, some of those insecurities and character defects. Those all left me at that time.
The social awkwardness had disappeared.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, right. And had melted away.
Exactly. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, wow, we're going to do this a lot. I was ready. I could come out and play.
Sure.
It's everything that I wanted, that I thought that I wanted to be.
So a conscious decision at that point, rationally, you made a conscious decision.
Yeah. I do not believe, and I will go on record, that I was predisposed for addiction.
Yeah.
I think I was predisposed with insecurities.
Sure.
With some, you know, some of the other issues that were going on, anxiety, you know, a little bit of depression here or there from just growing up in a normal childhood.
Sure.
But I don't believe to this day personally, it's just my own personal opinion, is that that I was predisposed to be a drug addict. I don't I don't believe that.
Well, and I have this strong feeling that because shame is such a big correlator with addiction, human beings are predisposed to shame. Right. You know, unless you're a sociopath or a psychopath or something.
Well, and I hadn't learned the coping skills or the life skills to deal with that anxiety. I hadn't learned the life skills to, you know, move past some of those insecurities that I had going in my life. So, you know, I started and right off the bat developing unhealthy behaviors. But I was conflicted, and it's important for me to share this part, you know, of this mindset, because the whole time, you know, because my life was already planned out for me. So, you know, I had, you know, it was planned that I was going to go on a Mormon mission. And so that perpetuates that guilt and shame.
Sure.
Now I've got to start holding secrets.
Right.
I got to, you know, stuff that, which I learned how to do that early on.
And to make that step, and but that's a huge rites of passage in the local community and within, you know, the Mormon theology, that, you know, the a big part of, you know, embracing that and owning that is that rites of passage for going on a mission.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, and to do so, one needs to be ready for that, and that means they're not carrying that kind of baggage, the substance abuse or any kind of abuse or, you know, improper relationships and those kinds of things with the, around.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And not only was it the mission, then it was, you know, the temple, to get married in a Mormon temple and to continue in the faith. That was all planned out for me. So the further that I got involved with alcohol, you know, my first experience with smoking marijuana was also in high school. You know, drugs, that was even on a whole nother level. And so that was very difficult, because early on I really felt like, you know, I wasn't being authentic. I felt like I was living a lie. And, you know, and of course, you know, I'm not going to, you know, come clean with that. And that weighed on me, you know, being a teenager and, you know, the direction that I was headed.
I can't be authentic. I can't. I mean, you know, this is who I'm supposed to be over here, and this is who I actually am. We call that, you know, the cognitive dissonance, right?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I think I'm supposed to be this person over here, and I believe that part of me can be, but I'm living this other life right now. Yeah. And what's authentic and what's not, and that's where that cognitive dissonance comes in. Yeah.
And so that became very burdensome. I mean, that required a lot of effort to be that chameleon, to kind of play to whatever crowd or audience or family member that I was with at the time. And, you know, then I graduate high school and, you know, then I'm off to college. I went up to Utah State University up in Logan, love Cache Valley, and I actually went up there on a golf scholarship. Had good grades
Obviously a good game, too.
A decent game. And that's an important part of my story as well, because my first year of college, you know, I was introduced to, you know, the sororities and the fraternities and, you know, kind of this whole other lifestyle, because now I'm outside of this shelter or this bubble that I'd grown up in Davis County. And so I was intrigued with that. I was, you know, that interested me, and, you know, and I made that connection with drugs and alcohol and the happiness and, you know, the good time. But I still had a firm grasp on this idea that I was going to go on a mission, which I did. In fact, you know, turned in my mission papers, received my mission call, actually went to the MTC on my 19th birthday. Down at the Missionary Training Center in Provo, I was called to go to Ecuador, to Guayaquil. Was amazing experience for me. Was able to learn another language, started to develop some discipline. And I think the most important awakening or aha moment that I had as a missionary was that I was engaged in service work.
Yeah.
I was engaged in serving other people. So now that became, for lack of a better term, my drug of choice, because all of a sudden now, in order to fill that void or that insecurity or that guilt or that shame, I was actively engaged in serving the people of South America.
Right.
I didn't feel tempted to drink or use some type of a mind-altering substance. That was my go-to, was serving those people. And regardless...
And you had a community, too. I mean, you were part of a community.
I did. I felt connected.
Yeah.
I had that human connection, whether it was forced onto me with a companion that I had by my side 24 hours a day, the church that I was involved in down there, the people needed us down in South America. There was love, there was compassion. There, you know, it was filling that void for me.
Right.
But the interesting part of that mission is as soon as I got back home from my mission, that was all taken away from me. I was back in school at Utah State University again.
So the community and the connections you were created during that time, which actually, this is a perfect example. That really was a rites of passage for you because you were, it's, I mean, I may be misinterpreting, but it sounds like you were living more of an authentic life.
Oh, absolutely.
You felt more connected to your truth.
I did.
Okay.
I did. And I, you know, I didn't have that guilt or the shame or regrets or, you know, I worked hard. I was a good missionary. I didn't break any rules. Part of it was because I was scared to death being in a third world country. And I was told if I didn't keep the rules, then, you know, I wouldn't be protected. So, you know, I really found my stride down there and fell in love with the people of South America. I loved the language, the culture, being connected, being part of a fellowship down there. And that was an amazing 2 years. Absolutely life-changing for me.
Yeah.
But quickly after returning back from South America, again, I'm back at school. I'm back up at Utah State playing golf, and in the off season, this is where my life changed forever. I went into the gym, wanted to try to keep up with the big football players and basketball players, and was lifting, and herniated my back.
Oh.
Herniated the L4, L5 discs in my back. And as a result of that, I went and saw the team doctor, and the team doctor wrote me my first prescription for a narcotic, for a pain medication.
Right.
And really what changed psychologically for me at the time was not the pain pills, but the way he delivered those to me by saying, Mike, this needs to remain between you and I, and no one else needs to know about this.
Oh.
Anytime you need these, come and see me. And we'll take care of it. You have a legitimate injury. You may be on these for a while. And that's what set in motion back, you know, the secrecy and, you know, not sharing it with family or friends.
Right.
And before I knew it, before I had, you know, developed a tolerance or even a psychological or a physical addiction to these, I mean, I was off to the races.
Wow.
So it was consistently an ongoing, you know, anytime I had any kind of pain in my back, I was taking these prescription medications.
Do you think in that instance with the doctor at that time that he was the idea that was about secrecy? Is that what the message you got from what he was saying?
That was my takeaway. I don't know if he had, you know, bad intentions or what his motives were, but what I heard was, other people aren't going to understand what you're going through, which resonated with me because I didn't feel like I fit in or people understood me anyways.
Yeah.
And then quickly, I made this connection that not only is it going to help the pain in my back, but when I'm stressed, I can take these. When I'm happy, I can take these. All of a sudden, it became my go-to.
Sure.
You know, all day, every day. And so before I knew it, it was, you know, I was taking pain medication, whether I needed it, you know, for a legitimate reason or not. I was taking it all day, every day.
You didn't know what your baseline of pain was anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And I was, you know, I was drowning in this. And, you know, it got quickly to a point to where, you know, I developed this physical, you know, addiction or, you know, tolerance to it, to where, you know, I wasn't getting happy anymore. It was all about just not getting sick anymore.
Right.
The sweats and the diarrhea and the constipation, you know, that going back and forth. And so at the time,
Every time that you would, you were obviously increasing the amounts you were taking every time that, you know, withdrawal would start. So would you go back to your doctor?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I'd ask for more.
Okay.
I'd ask for a higher dose.
Okay.
That's the first time I started doctor shopping, when he didn't ever cut me off, but when he would try to control it and say, you know, we need to be careful with this. Well, if I didn't get a yes here, then I would go to another doctor.
Okay.
So I quickly found a way around making sure that I needed to, you know, what I thought that I needed to get.
So it sounds like his intention was for you to learn to moderate this instead of consistently abuse it necessarily.
Right. Okay. You know, and I was never, you know, growing up, I was never really told no. I was, you know, it was kind of, you know, I grew up with a lot of opportunity in a fairly well-to-do family here. And, you know, I just, the selfish part of my story really, you know, is loud and clear because I'm very, very entitled. I have very, you know, the terminal uniqueness that the rules don't apply to me.
Right.
You know, that, you know, it, I learned to cheat early on, you know, in school in order to get good grades, and I didn't get caught.
Mm-hmm.
And so quickly, without having those types of consequences, I did the same thing with the pain meds.
Yeah.
You know, I just shopped around, right?
Yeah.
And then graduating from Utah State, the first job that I had out of school was I was a pharmaceutical sales rep. You know, you can imagine that's a great job for a drug addict.
It's a great job for a drug addict, yeah.
So I spent a lot of time in drug closets where they had the samples. And, uh-huh. You know, doctors would say, oh, yeah, we keep all of our narcotics locked up. No, they don't. I can find narcotics in the office. I had access to DEA numbers. Mm-hmm. This is when I now started to call in my own prescriptions as mm-hmm. if I was a doctor.
Yeah.
That really is what perpetuated, you know, my addiction and really took it to another level. Because now I'm lying, I'm cheating, deceitful, you know, really breaking the law.
Yeah.
You know, these are federal crimes. And right at that time, I had met a young girl, a very, very young girl, and we got married. I definitely wasn't worthy to get married in a Mormon temple, but that, as I mentioned earlier, that was planned out for me. So we got married in a Mormon temple here in Utah. And
well, and you wouldn't be the only person
in the
history of any temple anywhere.
Right,
but it may have been under the influence while
exactly,
they were.
Exactly. And, you know, I started that relationship right off the bat with a lie. And, you know, not being authentic and not being transparent. And, you know, and that was just who I had learned to become. Uh-huh. It was just a liar, a cheat, and a thief.
Yeah.
And if I took enough pain medication or muscle relaxers or, you know, any type of mind-altering substance, that would help remedy that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my go-to. That was my crutch, and that was my coping skill.
Were you just staying with the opiates at this time? Or?
No, I started to, you know, the Xanax, the Klonopin, you know, anything pharmaceutical.
Okay.
You know, I remember going into doctors.
Anything you could pick up from the closet, so
exactly.
to speak.
Yeah. I'd go into a drug closet and it would say, don't crush this. So I'd crush it. And it would say, don't mix this with this. So I would mix it, you know, because I was doing anything that I could to mask the pain. And really what it was is I just didn't like who I was.
Yeah.
I really didn't like who I was. And so we got married. We actually moved out of Utah. We moved to Vegas. I worked down there as a medical rep for a little while. I got involved in the real estate market. It was booming at the time. And we'd been there for a couple of years. And, you know, our marriage was a disaster. It was based on lies. She knew I was using. I was in denial the whole time, or at least pretending.
Did you
like,
ever communicate, talk about this? I mean,
well, we
as,
went
a,
to therapy.
As a couple?
Yeah,
went
we
to
went
therapy.
To therapy. Okay. She confronted me on it a couple of times, but I would always minimize it, or I would always say, well, I'm going to slow down. I really
So make some promises.
Yeah, make some promises.
Okay.
And, you know, I have a legitimate injury, so get off my back. Literally, no pun intended.
Right? Yeah.
But get off!
Right.
You know, I've got my meal ticket right here because I had a copy of my MRI. I could go to any doctor and hand them that because they would say, "Hey, Mike, you know, we should probably have that checked out." And I say, "Well, you know, Doc, it's interesting that you say that. I've actually got some results right here," and they'd look at it and say, "Okay, yeah, you've got a legitimate injury here." So we had been married close to 5 years, and we came back to Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an important part of my story because we came home. It was my my parents both celebrate their birthday the first week of May. And we were coming back for a family birthday party.
Hmm.
Well, it was one of those situations where we walked into the family room and the family's sitting there in a circle.
Oh.
We've all seen the reality show Intervention,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, right.
So I walk in completely lump in my throat. Thought, oh my gosh.
You knew, didn't you?
As soon as I walked in, no, I thought it was just a surprise birthday party.
No, but I mean, when you saw the room.
Oh, when I saw the room, I knew exactly what was going on because everyone had their letters. There was tears, my mom, and I'm thinking, it's my mom's birthday. Why is she crying, right? So I walk in and they begin to conduct an intervention. I get defensive. Part of me was relieved because I thought, okay, I've been found out now. Now I can go get some help. And this is the first time that I went off to rehab. I went to one of those high-priced jitter joints that I call them, where you go in there for 30 days, you shake like a leaf, right?
Mm-hmm.
They give you the acupuncture detox where they put the needles in your ears and they massage your feet. There was a nice, beautiful pool there on the property down in Arizona and absolutely loved it. Loved it. I remember sitting there. It was a 12-step facility, and that's where the seed was planted. I remember looking up at the 12 steps on the wall, and I kept thinking, okay, powerless. Yeah, I'm a little powerless. Is my life unmanageable? No, not yet. Not yet. I still got the wife. I got the car. I got the job. I got some money in my bank account. So at the end of 30 days, you know, I was done, came back to Utah, actually went to Highland Ridge to do an IOP. And I think I stayed sober for about 6 weeks. So I started to put a little bit of some sobriety together. I remember thinking
You started to get a sense of what it felt like to have the drugs out of your system.
Oh, yeah.
And starting to think.
Right.
Think clearly.
Right.
I mean, 6 weeks.
But I remember thinking, those steps are for you, not for me. I'm not as bad as you. You're a disaster, right?
Totally.
I'm really good at taking other people's inventory. So in order for me to separate myself and help myself feel better and validate where I was at, I was like, whoa, you've got the DUIs. You've been in and out of jail. I hadn't been there yet.
Yeah.
But the seed was planted.
Sure.
And I remember thinking to myself, there's a solution to this. If life gets bad enough, I can always go back to rehab.
Yeah.
And rehab's not bad. I mean, I've been to a couple of them.
Well, that's the source of a lot of this when we talk about that is the entitlement, right? Because if I'm really good at taking somebody else's inventory, I'm thinking everyone else is worse than I am, right?
Yeah. Right. And that's the paradox though, right? If I can judge you and make you feel less than in order for me to feel better about myself, but really we've learned through this recovery process, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so that was an impact. That had a huge impact on my life. Came back and she was part of the family program, but then she confronted me after I relapsed and she said, basically, you know, it's either me or it's the drugs, you know, and I selected the drugs. I made a conscious decision to say, listen, fine, you go do your thing. I'll do my thing. To be honest, you're hurting my buzz anyways. You know, I really don't.
Sure, because you have to deal with the reality of the relationship.
Exactly.
And, you know.
So I wanted her out of my life, and so we got divorced. We got divorced, and that's really where my life, you know, took a turn because I had financial freedom. I had flexibility. I started traveling quite a bit. And for the next few years, so that's between about 2005 to really about 2010, there was 5 years in there where I was traveling all over the world. You know, there was a lot of drugs involved because of my relationships in Vegas. There was a lot of time spent in Vegas. But again, that was a time of my life where I don't honestly remember a whole lot. That's
right.
When I started getting involved in more of this, the psychedelics like the LSDs and the ecstasies and, you know, kind of the club drugs, if you will, that were out there. Drinking every day. Of course, at this point now, you know, I'm drinking, you know, that's a consistent part of my story is when I couldn't get drugs in my body, you know, there was always drinking and it became a daily event.
Were you maintaining the opiates at this point or no?
A little bit, but what had happened was is I had made some Someone had introduced me to methadone, and I came to a point in my life where, you know, I was taking 30 to 40, you know, Lortab or Percocets a day, and that's a tough habit to sustain, expensive habit.
Yes.
And so someone introduced me to these methadone wafers where you can break them up into quarters, and I could take a quarter in the morning. And it'd get me through the day, and then I'd take a quarter of it in the evening, and then it would keep me from getting sick. And I did that for 2 years. I would just buy them off the street. I wasn't calling doctors anymore. I wasn't trying to get high. I was really scared of putting a needle in my arm. I had some family members that, you know, started to get involved in that. And so I was just trying to get by. So I was taking methadone consistently on kind of a medication-assisted therapy program. You know, I was
the harm reduction model.
Yeah, the harm reduction model. Exactly. And then one day...
Your own personal harm reduction
exactly,
model.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and then one day I went to go meet with my dealer. He actually lived up here in the Avenues, up here in Salt Lake City. And I couldn't find him. And a panic set in.
Oh.
And one of the neighbors came out and said, so-and-so got picked up on a probation violation and got involved in a pretty sticky situation, and he's in prison. So now all of a sudden, my supply had been cut off. So now I'm preparing myself to say, okay, I got to go check myself back in somewhere. Mm-hmm. I got to go get some help. And so what I do when things get tough is, I run. I call my older brother, David, and I called him up and said, bro, I need you to come pick me up and take me back to uni again.
You need a detox.
I need a detox. Yeah. I need some help here. So when I go to uni, I'm up there and I've never detoxed off of something like methadone in the past. And this was living hell. This was something I had no idea.
It wasn't 3 or 4 days.
No. It was weeks. In fact, my father came and visited me up at uni and he said, listen, Mike, if the family's going to help you out this time, this is 2010. If the family's going to help you out this time, we've sent some of our other family members to a rehabilitation facility in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. It's a boys' ranch. That's where you're going. So immediately I said, fine, developed a resentment, was pissed and said, all right, I'll go there. So I went and they shipped me off to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's called St. Christopher's. It's about a 6-month program. And I call it my redneck rehab experience. And it was tough. It was hard on me. It was more of a therapeutic community program. Yeah. It was all about discipline, hard work. I hated it. And I only lasted there for about 30 days. And then I came back to Utah, quickly relapsed. And then I had a friend who I used to run and gun with the drugs and the real estate, and his family lived in Argentina, in mm-hmm. Buenos Aires. And he says, Mike, why don't you come down here? So I saved up a little bit of money, and again, things get tough. It was funny because, I had a therapist early on say, Mike, you're a runner. And I said, no, I'm not. And he says, yeah, you are. He says, anytime things get tough in your life, you run away. Mm-hmm. And that's a common theme in my story. And so I ran away to South America. Mm-hmm. And I was there almost a year. I didn't intend on coming back, but things got really, really bad down there. Carlos is his name. He actually died of a drug overdose. And here I am back in Utah, faced with criminal charges, faced with all the really fallout and chaos that I had created before I left to go to Argentina. And within a couple of months, my little brother, Dustin Hawes, mm-hmm. it was June 29th, 2012,
right.
He passed away of a heroin overdose. That, for me, was the big game changer. That was one of those aha moments where, I just lost my best friend, I just lost my little brother, and honestly, I thought I was next. And within a couple of days of losing my little brother, mm-hmm. I crashed my car on the freeway on I-15 just before the Centerville off-ramp. And it was early one morning. In fact, I'd just been up at the cemetery buying some burial plots for my little brother to prepare for him. We mm-hmm. weren't ready for his death. Mm-hmm. And that morning, I'm driving back from Bountiful into Farmington and rolled my car on the freeway. Ended up in a ditch between I-15 and the frontage road, and my car was turned on its side. And I remember climbing out of the driver's side window and dusting myself off, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've got a bottle of vodka in the back seat. So I climbed back in my car. I remember cars had pulled over at that time. They're yelling at me, don't get in there, don't get in there. And I'm rummaging around in the back seat, and I find this bottle of vodka, and I toss it out in the weeds. And as soon as I got out of the car again, a police officer had stopped. I mean, that's how crazy, that's the insanity. Lose my buddy, lose my little brother, here I am drinking. Talk about powerless and unmanageability.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it was demonstrated on a lot of different levels there. So again, I go to jail again. I end up, I remember even before I went to jail that day, I remember waking up at the hospital, handcuffed to a hospital bed, go to jail, call my older brother, he bails me out. And this time, instead of taking me home, he takes me down to Red Barn Farms. My dad's sitting there at Red Barn Farms, and with tears in his eyes, he looks at me and he says, Mike, we just lost your little brother 2 days ago. Are we going to lose you too? Mm-hmm. And I had one of those moments where I just completely surrendered. His message, the love that I felt from him, just completely washed over me. And I looked at my dad and I said, I need some help. And he looked at me and he did something for me that I don't think he fully appreciates. But he said to me, he says, Mike, he said, we're here to support you. We're here to help you. Mm-hmm. What do you need? How can we best support you? Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting back thinking, okay, this is my decision now. I got to own this. And I remember saying to him, I said, there's a facility I would like to go to. I'd been checking it out, and because I know I needed some help. And so he said to me, he says, all right, give me 24 hours. He says, let me look into it and we'll help you. Within 45 minutes to an hour, he calls me. He says, if you'll go to Hazelden, which is now Betty Ford Hazelden.
Right, yeah.
He said, let's get you out of here. We're going to support you. So now this is my idea. He was using motivational interviewing and didn't even know he was doing it, right? And it all started right there at Red Barn Farms.
I mean, I know your dad and he's a smart guy.
He's a smart guy, but he was also, you know, he's a dictator in my family, right? He said, this is the way it's going to be done.
He was
right?
definitely the patriarch.
He was the patriarch. Yeah, so this is the first time, you know, I actually had a seat at the table and he says, all right, Mike, this is your decision.
Yeah.
And we're going to support you.
Yeah.
So I went off to Hazelden.
Well, you had to have the buy-in. Otherwise, you know, someone's just telling you what to do, and there's that underlying, you know, level of resistance that just is constantly there if we don't have the buy-in.
Exactly.
For anybody at any time.
And that's exactly what you do with the work that you do. Mm-hmm. That's what we try to implement here at Red Barn. You know, a little bit on a different level just because of the discipline that's involved out there. But that was a game changer for me. That was such a pivotal moment in my recovery because now I'm going and doing it because now this is what I want to do. This is what I choose to do. And a series of events had transpired in my life where it had just gotten to a point where I honestly believe this is my last shot. And what do I have to lose? You know, let's give this my, you know, best effort. Yeah. So Hazelden, amazing experience. The best part of this last time, knock on wood, I hope I don't go back to treatment again, unless it's just for a quick little refresher. But when I came out of Hazelden, I went into transitional housing.
Yeah.
I went to Project Recovery,
yeah.
Which is no longer around. I remember going there and they said, okay. And I thought to myself, I'm going to come here for 30 days. And they said, no, the minimum stay here is 90. Yeah. And I said, don't you know who I am? You know, I got shit. I got places to be. I got people to see.
Yeah.
I got amends to make at this point, right? So I go to Project Recovery and I end up staying there for 6 months. And then they kept me on as a recovery coach. And I ended up staying there almost a year. And I remember my friends calling me from treatment and said, Mike, you're sober. How are you doing? And I thought, well, damn it. I'm still in treatment. I'm still in a controlled environment. I'm in a community
now.
You're
in a community.
I'm participating actually in 12 steps. I'm going to meetings. I'm doing service work. I'm finally doing all the things that had been taught to me.
Yeah.
You know, so first time I'm introduced to recovery is 2004. 2012 is my sobriety date. So it took me 8 years of just trying to, you know, kind of make my way through this and finally surrendering and saying, all right. And I've thought about this. The best decision I ever made was firing myself as CEO of my life in 2012. Because if you would have followed me around and you saw the toes that I stepped on and the relationships that I destroyed and the jobs I lost, you would have said, whoever's running that guy's life is out to destroy him. But the crazy part of it is it all made sense to me.
Right.
So
right.
Finally I surrendered and said, okay, clearly I need to listen to some people that have a little more experience. Mm-hmm. And that's where it all changed for me.
Yeah.
And during that period of time, I went back to Red Barn Farms. No one else would hire me with my record being a felon and DUIs and things like that. And I started working around the farm. I started working with the animals. I started working in the greenhouse. I remember my dad saying to me, Mike, whatever you do here at Red Barn, do not bring any of your plants that you have from your prior life here. Just promise me. And I made a commitment and I'm happy to say even to this day, I haven't brought any of those plants in. I don't know what's going to happen here with medical marijuana, but that's a story for another day. But I immediately started into the work side, the discipline. I found it became much easier for me to work with animals than human beings. And that's what we teach our guys at Red Barn today is the service component of they're much more likely to work with the alpacas and the dogs and the cats. And then we start connecting it back to the human connection, which becomes important.
Well, get their hands in the dirt, too. I mean, there's such a big part of...
Well, and we believe that there's microbes, there's all these healing factors, natural healing factors of getting your hands dirty.
No doubt.
And then a job well done. I mean, it's amazing to watch my guys when they're out in the greenhouse planting seeds, and then they take those seeds as starter plants, and they move them out into the gardens, and now they're harvesting right now. Now they're making salsa with their tomatoes and onions, and there's this sense of accomplishment, which for most of these guys, they've never experienced. In their lives.
Right.
So I started early on. And then like any good drug addict early in recovery, I went back and got a social work degree. Because now, right, I'm going to go back and save the world.
Yeah.
Probably one of the most selfish, self-centered decisions I've ever made. But I jumped back into social work, went and got a substance use disorder counseling license, got introduced to some wonderful people here that run the different facilities, wonderful professors, you know, from, you know, Dr. Dusso to Sean McMillan to, you know, it was just such a wonderful experience to get exposed to that. But it also taught me that I'm not a very good clinician. That I don't really do well with techniques like motivational learning. I mean, I was sitting, to be honest with you, I'm sitting in my disciplinary council. Mr. Mm-hmm. Santiago Cortez is asking me the questions, mm-hmm. and I'm getting to the end of my 18-month probationary period with mm-hmm. Doppel. And he says to me, he says, Mike, he says, so what have you learned through this experience? And I looked at him, I said, Mr. Cortez, I said, can I be honest? He said, please do. Now, you have to know that you're sitting in this room with about 15 of the most powerful people in the treatment industry here in Utah. They've got a video camera on you. They're tape recording you. And I looked around and I said, I've learned, Mr. Cortez, that I'm a terrible counselor. And he started laughing. He says, well, what are you good at? And I says, I'm good at discipline. I'm good at hard work. I have integrity today. I'm trustworthy. All the principles and all... really, the goals and objectives that we teach
sure.
our guys at Red Barn.
Yeah.
We're not, we were not very, it's tough because we try to be empathetic. We try to be sympathetic, but when it comes down to it, the students that we work with today respond much better to discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, we're a nicotine free campus.
Yeah.
Every one of our guys that come either smoke or use some type of a tobacco product.
Sure.
The first thing I say to them is, do you smoke? Do you use tobacco? Without fail, they say yes. And I say, congratulations, you just quit. The moment that I take that off the table, it becomes a non-factor.
Right.
Now, do they act out and do they go do things? When they're, yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
But when we make those decisions,
they didn't stop being human beings just to know.
Right. Yeah, right. But it is amazing how quickly they respond to that with the discipline that's
yeah.
in place.
Yeah.
So then we got together, my dad and I, and with the family, and we started using what we've got out there today, this little farm, this little red barn out there that was built back in 2008. We start hosting Al-Anon meetings out there, AA meetings. We didn't really know what we were doing in the beginning, other than we wanted to shine a light on addiction in our community. Sure. Because really, when we lost my little brother, we really felt like we were faced with one of two decisions. Either mm-hmm. we could continue in denial,
yeah.
pretending like there wasn't a problem here in our little community, or we could use our resources and that farm to be part of the solution.
Yeah.
Thank God, you know, with some support of the community, we decided to use that little red barn
mm-hmm.
and where it's at today to be part of a solution for
addiction. Well, and that was quite a road, too, yeah. because when I met you, it wasn't that long after your brother
exactly.
had passed. I mean, you know, that year anyway. And, you know, you guys, you know, we're looking at what are the different options we have? What can we do? And, you know, when I met you, there was just the two buildings or, you know,
yeah.
I mean,
the animal barn and
the greenhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the greenhouse. And then, you know, the plans slowly came together and, you know, I mean, I know it reformed at different times and sort of evolved and
right.
then, and finally the vision after time, which I think is one of the beautiful stories of Red Barn, is how that evolved. I mean, the vision for where you wanted to go and what you wanted to create, I think is a power to your family, you, of course, Mike, but also your family and what they wanted to create and
right.
what they wanted to offer. And now you do have this amazing community in the model. Can you talk a little bit about this model? Because, you know, I'm familiar with it and you know, we have another organization in town, the Other Side Academy, that has something similar.
Right.
It follows a similar kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was first introduced to the therapeutic community model actually in a social work textbook up at the University of Utah. And I remember reading about this foundation called the Delancey Street Foundation mm-hmm. in San Francisco. And it talked about changing behaviors. And it talked about discipline and hard work. And most importantly, length of time. And I remember thinking to myself, I got to go check this place out. It had, at that time, a 40-year track record. It had been around for quite some time. It's a model. Some may say it's a little controversial, but had been studied, had been a proven success. And so I grabbed a couple of our board members and a couple of my family members, and we went down to Delancey Street. And we did what was called their replication training. So they showed us how they set it up, how they run their program, their curriculum, the way they run their confrontation groups that they call games. And it really started to spark an interest in myself personally, because that's how I was living. That's how I started to live my life. Mm-hmm. But also thinking to myself, because my personal bias was, you know, what could have helped my little brother? He didn't need to go to treatment again. He didn't need to go to jail again. He needed to learn some life skills.
Yes.
He needed to learn how to make his bed. He needed to learn how to show up on time and, you know, wash his clothes and how to cook for himself. You know, all the things that Delancey Street taught. And they did it through consistent discipline. And the minimum stay was 2 years. And I thought to myself, well, how do we make this work? Because length of time in the industry, we would all agree upon, is one consistent, you know, success, if there's a marker, is length of time. And so we were introduced to Delancey Street. And then we took a trip to visit Vulcan, the Vulcan Academy. You know, they're up in Canada, and then we visited their location in Seattle, and now they've got one down in Arizona. And so what we've done as an organization is we've gone out and done a lot of research and development. We've gone out and visited a lot of facilities. And at the same time, we still tried to stay open-minded to the fact, what does our community need here in Davis County?
Right.
And because we have a very active board, the board would say, well, you need to do clinical, or you need to at least work with insurance companies. And so we took a 6-month learning experience, cost us quite a bit of money, but we went out and hired a clinician to come in and help run our program. We tried to get panel. I'll always remember, you know, trying to work with companies like Blue Cross and Blue Shield. I brought some of their representatives out to the farm as we were trying to get accredited and get paneled with them. And they said, Mike, tell us a little bit about some of your workshops. And I was really excited because we had all these beehives that we have at the farm, and we put on our bee suits, and we have this, you know, balance workshop about trying to find, you know, balance in our lives. Because bees, the worker bees, are a lot like good drug addicts, right? With enough time and money, we run ourselves in the ground.
Of course,
And, you know, and this representative from Blue Cross Blue Shield looks at me and goes, you can't do that. We can't have that type of a workshop. And then we went into the greenhouse, and she said to me, she goes, well, what about the soils over there? And you've got all these chemicals over there. I said, well, it's a greenhouse. She goes, well, you can't do that. So as we made our way around the farm, it became very clear that what she was telling us, that what we could and couldn't do, didn't sit real well with us.
Right. Yeah.
And then we had that experience with Medicaid. And so over a 6-month period of time, we really felt like we gave a sincere effort to try to become a residential treatment center, to become licensed. And it just, it didn't sit well with, and that we've talked about being authentic. We weren't being authentic.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think about that scene from Lion King where, you know, Mufasa comes back and visits Simba and says, you've forgotten who you are.
Yeah.
And that's what we had done at Red Barn. We were trying to acquiesce to the marketplace. We were trying to let, you know, the insurance companies run our program.
Sure.
And we said, time out. We're not going
to
do that.
And try to maybe, and what I'm hearing is this idea of not being authentic, attempting to be something you weren't.
Exactly.
Because it really didn't, you know, resonate with you and what the model that you know had worked, and you realized that you needed to do something different.
Right. So. And so that's when I reached out. You mentioned the Other Side Academy. They've been around a couple years longer than we have. I reached out to their chairman, who's a good friend, and I just said, listen, I need some help. And he said, why don't you come move in to the Other Side Academy? We will share with you our program, our curriculum. They have been such wonderful mentors and friends and coaching us. In fact, there was a point that I went to the Other Side Academy. I said, come help me. I believe in your model so much. I believe in the therapeutic community model so much. Come help me run Red Barn. And in their wisdom, they said, Mike, you're onto something here. Stay the course. You're going to be just fine. We'll help you along the way. But you've got a beautiful farm here. You're going to be able to do things here that we can't even do here
right.
at our facility.
Yeah.
And so that's what's been so beautiful about this relationship working with these other therapeutic communities is we have the same goal.
Yeah.
You know, we're here to help each other. We're here, I mean, as altruistic as it sounds, we're here to save lives, but we're here to work with certain individuals that don't necessarily fit in the biopsychosocial system or model.
Sure.
So these are individuals that are not on medication. These are individuals that don't have a severe history of mental illness and schizophrenia and bipolar. You know, the list goes on and on. We don't bring those individuals.
Right.
Our individuals need to learn how to change behaviors.
Yeah.
So I would say...
Well, and develop life skills.
Exactly.
I mean, that's one of the biggest parts of this, of course.
Yeah. And so that's what I think is the big misunderstanding about therapeutic communities is, you know, there's people who lack the knowledge or the experience. And they say, well, your population of people needs to be on meds. Not necessarily. I'm a perfect example. Yeah, when I was out drinking and, you know, I was depressed. When I was out using speed, I, you know, had anxiety. Well, you take those things away from me, I'm not a depressed person today.
Right.
I don't have anxiety today.
Right.
But I did lack discipline.
Yeah.
I did lack the life skills. So when people say, who's appropriate to come to Red Barn? I say, well, it's a guy's a lot like me, you know, that developed some unhealthy behaviors along the way, and we need to help correct those.
Sure.
And it takes time and discipline and hard work. So really, that's what kicked off this idea of becoming a therapeutic community. In fact, we worked with the Other Side Academy on House Bill 468 this last legislative session.
Right.
So we are licensed as a residential life skills academy.
Right.
We're not treatment, we're not detox, we're not clinical, and we're not going to pretend to be that.
Right.
So, you know, becoming a therapeutic community is really, this is our identity. This is who we are. So we had that experience with trying to become clinical. I'm happy to say we've checked that box. That's not who we are. We work very closely with the other treatment centers here in Utah and here in the West United States. I would say for every 10 individuals that think they want to come to Red Barn, we refer them out elsewhere. We screen them very, very thoroughly. A lot of our guys are incarcerated right now. So they're in jail looking at prison sentences. And so we're perceived as a criminal justice system as an alternative to incarceration. Let's say they're very highly motivated to come to Red Barn. And, you know, most of them have had quite a bit of treatment and quite a bit of counseling. And
they've already been through the basic biopsychosocial model,
exactly.
You know, in the traditional mental health model.
Well, we're educated
over and
addicts,
over and again,
right? We're educated addicts. We can run group. We know what to tell a therapist. And so we need to bring them into a controlled environment, a controlled setting where we can confront them on those behaviors and their peers can hold them accountable.
Right.
And so that's the beauty of the therapeutic model is the peers run the program.
Right.
You know, I had a judge say to me the other day, he goes, so Mike, you're telling me you're going to bring in these drug addicts, these con artists, these liars, cheats, and thieves, and you're going to ask them to run the program. He says, how are you going to do that? And I said, no disrespect, Your Honor, but I'm going to ask them to do it. I'm going to treat them like human beings. I'm going to empower them. I'm going to put some safety measures there in place. We drug test them. You know, we do have some supervision that's there. But I said, Your Honor, the reason why they act like animals in prison is because we treat them like animals.
Yeah.
If we start treating these people like human beings, self-worth, you know, paying attention to what their needs are, it's amazing how these individuals respond.
Yeah.
And I've got some guys. I mean, you can see their rap sheets. They're scary guys. And they are the kindest, most loving. You know, we have our little issues along the way.
Of course.
But I got to tell you, these are the most kind, you know, individuals that you'll meet in your entire life. And all they needed was a chance. And they are, I would say, the bottom 10%. These are the people that their families have given up on them. The criminal justice system has given up on them. I mean, they're ready to lock them up forever.
Yeah.
And I go in and plead with the judge and with the prosecutors and say, give us a chance.
Yeah. There's this part of this, Mike, that, and I use the term learned helplessness a lot, and it's, I think in some ways it applies to this population where they may focus, they may have refined their criminality in such a point, you know, which is, you know, the deceit and the deception and the entitlement that, you know, the rules don't apply to me, right. All the antisocial stuff. But the truth is they have this stance of, you know, I'm helpless. I can't change who I am, that there's nothing that has happened up to this point that they can believe that they can do anything differently or think any different way, that this is their destiny. This is almost their destiny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is what I like and appreciate about the therapy community. One of the things that at Wasatch, when I came there, you know, 4 years ago was, to create and develop the IOP and the day treatment program. But the most important component of what I believe that I still do there is the aftercare program. And I really ask people to commit 1 year to coming to this, to building a community, and that this is your group. You run this group. I mean, we're there to moderate it. A therapist is. But the truth of the matter is, this is, you should be doing this yourself. Right. You should take ownership and accountability.
Right.
Shoulda, woulda, coulda, but own it.
Right.
Take it. This is yours.
Right.
And commit to a year.
Yeah.
It's not that much, really, when you're in the middle of it. And you'll learn a lot about yourself and about other people in the process. So I know it's not quite parallels the same way, but
it's the same mentality and the same psychology. Because ours is a minimum of 2 years. But what we're finding out with the therapeutic community models is once they fulfill that commitment of 2 years and they opt to stay for a third year, that's where the magic really happens. Because now they're doing it because they want to.
Right.
So we teach natural consequences for actions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if a guy gets put on contract at Red Barn, which means they violated a major rule, and we'll put them in a bright, green, fluorescent green shirt, and they'll literally go out and pick up rocks for 10 hours. Right? Because of that behavior. Maybe they picked up a cigarette and smoked a cigarette or did something like that. So initially they start making that connection with, okay, if I smoke a cigarette, this is going to be the consequence for my action.
Sure.
What we start to see after about 6 months to a year, and I'm experiencing it with my students right now, they're moving away from the penalty or the punitive side. And now they start making the connection to, well, if I actually follow the rules, I become a productive member here at Red Barn, now I'm sleeping better. Now I'm happy.
Right.
So there's this paradigm shift from this punitive side over to now I'm doing it because now I understand the benefits.
Yes.
But see, we can't be so naive to think that the guys that I work with right now, as difficult as it is for you to lie, that's how difficult it is for them to tell the truth.
Right.
They're not capable of telling the truth.
Yeah.
So I have to see these guys for who they are. They're liars, cheats, and thieves. A lot of people will come in and see these guys and they're doing great. And they held the door for me. And, that's their drug right now is that validation.
Sure.
Right?
Seeking validation and approval.
Exactly. So we have to be very careful.
Yeah.
So that first 2 years, it's very, very painful. But when they get to that third year, and what's fun, and this is what we've learned from Delancey and the Other Side Academy, is we have what's called Red Barn Enterprises. So once they complete that 2 years, we're not kicking them out. See, our model is based on the needs of the individual. It's not based on the funding. I mean, I talked to a buddy the other day who owns a treatment center, and I said, so you're telling me when they run out of money, you kick them out? And he goes, no, I wouldn't kick them out. If they need to stay longer, I'll let them stay longer. I said, well, what if they need 6 months? Oh, no, I can't do that. I can't do 6 months. Well, we have the luxury to be able to do that at Red Barn. So when they move out of that bunkhouse, that first 44 beds, we're building what's called transitional housing.
Right.
That's the alumni piece.
Yeah.
That's the connection piece to stay
aftercare.
Connected. The aftercare. We call it continuing care that continues on. They can work in one of the Red Barn Enterprise businesses. At that point now, they can start receiving some income that starts to come in. We've got Red Barn Construction. We've got the Red Barn Moving Department. We've got Red Barn Culinary Art School. We're building what's called Red Barn Chicken right now.
I saw that recently.
Did you see that?
I did that. That looks what a great concept.
Well,
by the way,
the students, it's amazing. The students are involved with the theming of it, the taglines, the menu. Our same students that are living there at Red Barn, they're the ones that are going to be serving you your chicken fingers. The revenues that come off of Red Barn Chicken, that's what's going to come back to the nonprofit at Red Barn Farms, so we can continue to build out the dream.
So the funding, you internalize the funding within the system, and it becomes self-sustaining up to a certain point, obviously.
And these guys know. They know that what it costs to pay the light bill. They know what it costs to pay, the gas bill. We share those numbers with them. So they've been able to really put together a budget and identify that, hey, it doesn't cost anything to the individual or family to come to Red Barn. You got to make the commitment. You're going to work your guts out. So you're going to work all day, every day, 6 days a week. And then you're going to go to a life skills workshop that evening, right? And you're going to do that every single day for 2 years. And it's hard. And we call it recovery boot camp.
Yeah.
But that's how we're able to pay the bills and keep the lights turned on. And in the interest of full disclosure, we're not even at a break-even point. We're excited because this next week we get to share the complete transparent financials with our students, so they fully understand that, they're working hard, but they're not working hard enough. And isn't that really what life is all about, right? We can always do more.
Right.
So that part of teaching them those life skills becomes very, very important. It's not just you're just going to work to punch, really a clock. You're actually you're participating in the community, and what you're bringing back is what's helping the community.
It's not focusing on the paycheck itself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
But what it sources in your life, which is a whole different approach. This idea, I think, this sort of like missing link that's been going around, and I know that we're focusing on a certain population, and there, I mean, I was thinking about this in group the other day. I mean, there was someone in there that I had think had been through treatment 13 times, and I mean, and they have this, I've already brought this up, this sense of learned helplessness where, you know, they just, you can see in the way they think and they talk that they believe on some level that something is possible, but they have no experience with it with creating any type of success, or at least consistent success in their life, so that they feel able or capable. And then what perpetuates are these old belief systems about oneself, mostly negative, that something's wrong with me and that I'm not okay. And one of the first things that I think is important to dispel is that, you know what, you are okay and you are enough, and it's just you need to learn to do things differently, and this is just a learning process. And one of the other things that we've been working on changing too is this, the terminology around the word hard. And we say, yes, this can be hard, but is it hard or is it uncomfortable?
Right.
Because it's things, you know, when we tell ourselves that something's hard, we almost like put a hurdle we have to get over to accomplish it. But if I accept that, well, maybe it's not really hard, but it's uncomfortable to go through the feelings associated with this, it maybe starts that reprogramming process that, well, it's just uncomfortable. I don't like feeling uncomfortable, which is why I used, you know, drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling, women, you know, whatever.
See, and for us, just so you know, one of the rules at Red Barn is we don't talk about drugs. We don't talk about alcohol. In fact, we don't even talk about our past. We talk about the behavior. And so that's why I kind of chuckle when we talk about this opioid epidemic, because we all know that 10 years from now, it's going to be meth, and then 20 years from now, it's going to be cocaine. It has nothing to do with the opioids. It has everything to do with the behavior.
It's a symptom. Yeah. Right? And I mean, I wrote a book about this.
Exactly.
About the whole thing is that the opioids are just a symptom.
Exactly. You know? So we tell our guys, I don't care if you got the gambling, you got all the war stories. We're not about that here at Red Barn, because we know that if we can teach the integrity, the honesty, and the consistency of that over time, we're going to be just fine. And I also am very clear with my students when I bring them in, as I say, listen, this is a pressure cooker. My job as the director here is to poke and prod at you. I want you to be angry. I want you to be sad. I want you to be joyful, happy, feel all these emotions hundreds and hundreds of times and not go get high.
Right.
Because I would be remiss if you left Red Barn and you went out and said, oh my gosh, I've never felt this way before. I don't know how to deal with this. Mm-hmm. So I love that when you say uncomfortable. My job, and really, it's a roller coaster ride. If things start to get a little bit mellow at Red Barn, I become very concerned.
No, that's so
And I got to shake it up. Because I'm like, what are these guys hiding?
Yeah.
Because the thing that I've learned about working with someone who has a history of drug use versus alcohol use, and you could probably shed some more light on this, but my guys that have been active drug users for quite some time, they act outwardly. I mean, they wear their emotions on their sleeves. Alcoholics, in my just short time of doing this, they act almost inwardly, and they isolate, and they're more quiet. So I love the drug addicts that, you know, punch the wall and smash the glass and storm out of the room.
Sure.
Because I can work with that.
Yeah.
I'm always concerned when someone gets quiet and they start to isolate and they won't talk. But my drug addicts, man, they're fantastic because they lose their minds. And so we're patching holes in the walls and we're fixing things. And, you know, we're teaching them
to patch holes.
Yeah, exactly. But we can work with that. And so that's an important component for these guys to understand. And that's why at Red Barn, we don't subscribe to this idea that, you know, addiction is a disease.
Yeah.
We don't fall back on those crutches.
Yeah.
We're not going to give them an out. And I remember early on in my own recovery, I loved to think it was a disease. So if and when I relapsed, that I had a reason for it, right?
Yeah, right.
So we don't play that game with these guys. And the other component that I would say is very fundamental to what we're doing at Red Barn that other therapeutic communities don't do is we're actually developing a family program. I was talking with someone from Delancey Street the other day, and I said, tell me about your family program. He said, oh, we don't have one. I said, well, what do you tell your students, you know, your, mm-hmm. your residents? They said, we tell them the family program is go find a new family because you're not going to be able to work with that old one. So we're teamed up and we've been studying this now for a couple of years because we're convinced that at the right time, and it may be after they complete the 2 years,
sure.
that we have to figure out a way to integrate them back to the family. And we all believe this in the industry that the byproduct of the work we do uh-huh. is our relationships get better. I mean, I would like to just touch on personally, you know, where I'm at today as a result of the work that I've done.
Yeah.
You know, I've been married now for 5 years to the most beautiful, amazing woman. You know, I jokingly say she's a workaholic. I'm an alcoholic. but she's so supportive. Uh-huh. You know, I start losing my mind. She says, Mike, you need to go hang out with your alcoholic friends. Mm-hmm. Go hang out with your sponsor. Mm-hmm. Just recently, we had a little baby boy, Maverick.
Yes, congratulations.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, it is the most beautiful. I had no idea. And part of it goes back to, you know, feeling like, you know, I don't deserve this lifestyle or this life because of the guilt and the shame that I felt my entire life. Uh-huh. And so the byproduct of the work that I've been able to do, not just at Red Barn, but in my own personal recovery and the little family that I have is it's the most amazing thing in the world. And, you know, my wife being such a solid rock in our relationship, because I still lose my mind, you know, all the time and she reels me back in.
Sure.
And so that's the part that we really want to be able to share with our students, because most therapeutic communities, they don't get back into the family. So you start talking about community mm-hmm. and you start talking about the connection.
Right.
That's the thing that I believe that therapeutic communities fall short on is they work with the individual,
yeah.
but they don't bring him back with the family.
Yeah. And I don't know if you know, but I you know, we did go back and get my marriage and family therapist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talk about
yeah.
that.
So, but because I believe so much in that model, yeah. I really believe in exploring the family system deeply, and it's talk about it being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's very uncomfortable for the family. It's, you know, to have to look at, you know, what their part of, you know, what their part in this is.
Right.
So I believe in the family systems. I believe in the cybernetic model of that
right.
everything has an effect right. on each other, and that these things don't happen in a vacuum. And sometimes the antisocial or the drug addict is an actual is sort of like the identified patient or the you know, the problem child is something is the way the family uses that person as a scapegoat
oh,
quite
yeah.
often
oh, yeah.
and that the system itself that has to be addressed
right.
even though it's as difficult as dealing with the person who's in their program
right.
whatever that is or their community, the family also needs to address
but
that.
But don't you think though that sometime even that family dynamic, see, we're in such a controlled setting. I've got these guys for 2 years. They're living there at the farm. You know, they are constantly being held accountable by, we call them their battle buddy.
Yeah.
200% accountability. But some of the challenges we've even had at Red Barn is we've had families come up in the middle of the night and drop stuff off, contraband and cigarettes and chew. And, you know, and so as setting a boundary, we just say, families are off limits. I mean, yeah. our guys can't
Well, no, that
even,
has to be. That in that kind of
so
situation.
So how do you integrate, or when is the right time to integrate the family back into
yeah.
the life of, you know,
that's
the
a really good, that's a great question. I don't know if there's ever a perfect time, to be
right.
honest with you, Mike, but I think that the idea approach from that the family, we invite the family to participate on some level, and part of that may be separately for a while to give them some tools. One of the things that I learned from Brett Heiner,
right?
When we've been working together for, oh my gosh, 20, well, no, almost 20 years, was this idea, and he used to do interventions too, but he would do them, he would get the families together and educate them,
right?
And give them this training and give them, teach them. Some understanding of addiction and how it works, and then talk about the family systems and how it works. And
right.
I get that. I mean, that's looking at it from somewhat of a systemic model,
right.
And it takes sort of all the control and the power away from the person that's doing all the acting
right.
out.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, we can talk about this more too. But the how that happens, I think that when you're developing and you're looking to develop a program, I would do it in such a way that the families are being given the time to be educated
right.
and being given the opportunity to learn and be able to look at you know, the family system in itself, which again is really uncomfortable because quite often the person in treatment or in the other program is the one that has been, you know, they've said, well, if that person was just well, everything else would be fine.
Right.
They have been the scapegoat for so long.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one of our goals. We really feel like we've developed our curriculum and actually have a model that, you know, we've got guys that have been in the program for over a year. We feel like we have a real strong foundation, but I think our next opportunity is to develop the integration back with the family.
Hats off to you. That's so important.
That's what we're real excited about. And we've got some wonderful community partners. We've got some active board members that are involved that have a history of that. Some therapists, some clinicians. In fact, one of our board members is Judge Mehmet, the retired district court judge that developed the whole drug court system for Davis County. So he's involved with that. We're working with a group called the Arbinger Group that does conflict resolution.
I'm familiar with Arbinger.
So all of these groups are coming together to say, how do we put together a program to help these students at Red Barn? Because see, right now we only have a men's facility.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is to build a women and children's facility. We've got to build the transitional housing. Ultimately, we see close to 150 individuals living at Red Barn Farms.
Wow.
So that's where we've got a long way to go. We've made some progress, but we still, it's like I tell my board, if we're going to dream, let's dream big.
Yeah.
And let's do the Red Barn Chicken, and then let's take the Red Barn Academy and Red Barn Chicken and take it on the road. And what's cool about the chicken piece, too, is because that's where we're going to really be able to tell our story. Mm-hmm. It's tough to bring very many people to Red Barn Farms to tell the story. We're always tour ready. We're not a medical facility, so we have an open door policy.
Mm-hmm.
But with the chicken restaurant, we're going to have storyboards set up. We're going to talk about the individuals and their success stories. And, you know, like you saw, you know, in the social media, we could have a tagline like, you know, save the world from addiction, eat more chicken. So that's going to give us our platform and our social initiative to really tell the story about Red Barn.
Sure.
So that's something that we're extremely excited about. So when you come up to the Red Barn campus, you know, it literally will be a campus that will have men, women, and children. It'll have transitional housing. It'll have our enterprises right there on the campus. And it will be a self-sustaining and a self-reliant model that we put together.
Beautiful. That's beautiful.
So
what a great dream that you and your family have manifested with the help of the community.
Yeah.
I know I've been to a few of those meetings with with some of your board members and things and noticed, I mean, this is years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, just even before you started building, you know, the transitional piece and any of that, or the housing for the men.
Yeah.
I think last time I was there, you were just digging the foundation or the footings or whatever.
But doesn't it lend itself to this idea that it's about the process, right, Paul? I mean, you know, it's not about the destination.
No.
I mean, it took us almost 2 years to build that bunkhouse when it really should have taken 8 or 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll take us probably a little bit longer to build the Red Barn Chicken because the students are going to help us. It's the each one, teach one concept. So when we're doing the foundation, we want 10 students to learn how to do the excavation.
Yeah.
When we're doing the concrete, we want another 10 students to learn how to do the concrete and the electrical and, you know, the sheet rocking and everything that goes along with that and develop those life skills. That's really what it's all about. And then they're getting that confidence and they're feeling accomplished and, you know, they're overcoming and they're changing that dialogue in their head.
Yeah.
And that's a common theme at Red Barn is we got to change the story in order to change our future.
Yeah.
We got to change it.
Yeah. Rewriting, reprogramming, editing our narrative is to me the most important thing that we do in our lives personally.
Yeah.
The sense of, you know, we create a reality based upon our story, but we also, which is the good news, right?
Right.
I mean, that's really good news when we come to it because that means I wrote it. Guess what? I can rewrite it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And see, and it's such a beautiful thing that we have at least 2 years. My heart goes out to these, you know, Wasatch and you know, Cirque and all these places that have 30, 60, 90 days. I'm just thinking, man, we don't even bring our students into the community till after they've been there for 30 days. We do what's called a commitment ceremony. So they just come in for the first 30 days and they're just still trying to figure out what's going on.
Right.
And then, you know, they're there literally 30 to 90 days before they become what's called a freshman. And then they're a freshman for 6 months. So they don't even become a resident of Red Barn till they have a year in the program.
Wow.
So it does. It takes time. And I know it's not for everyone, but, you know, we feel very blessed that we have a farm up there where we can bring them in for that length of time to change that behavior.
Yeah, you're doing important work by all means. Okay, I'm going to shift a little bit, ask you some questions about Mike a little bit. So throughout your life, and I think you talked a little bit about this today, but, you know, a mentor, something that has stood out to you, and there was whatever lessons kind of came along with that. Does anything stand out in your life of a person or a time or a place where you felt that there was a strong personal development and sort of aha moments where you kind of had developed some insight? And was it, you know, based upon a mentor or something that you know,
so happened? And that's a great question, because for me, you know, pain is a great motivator. I call it enforced humility, right? You know, and so I
that's
find
a good one.
I find myself in these moments where that we talk about the gift of desperation.
Yeah.
Where I've you know, I've given up my all, and clearly, you know, my best thinking got me to where I'm at today.
Right.
And so I tell my guys a lot, I said, you know, when you have a good idea, call me. When you have a great idea, get your ass over to my house, because your great ideas, I usually have to come visit you in jail. So I find myself, even as far as I am removed from my last unhealthy behavior, mm-hmm. still I've got a team around me. Most people that know me know that I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. I have a wonderful sponsor. I check in with him. He's a big book thumper. He goes to a lot of meetings. Mm-hmm. I don't go to half, even a third of the meetings that he goes to. So he's always challenging me on that, which is good because it holds me accountable. It keeps me involved with the community. But I would say my last counselor, when I was at Hazelden, mm-hmm. had a huge impact on me, because I felt like I was prepared to receive what he was teaching me. I don't think it was a new idea. I don't believe mm-hmm. there's anything new in recovery. I think it's about repetition. Mm-hmm. But I was willing. I was open. I had realized that I'd gotten to a place where, you know, something's got to change. And he told me that something is everything. And I honestly, it was like I'd heard it the first time. I know I'd heard it before, but I came back. I changed my job. I changed, you know, where I lived. I changed my playground, my playthings. I changed it all. And he just said, trust the process, you know, and that had a huge, huge impact. And so I did a lot of journaling mm-hmm. at that time. And so I will go back and I will revisit those. And I have those moments again where I'm like, okay, this is where I'm off track. I've got mm-hmm. to get back on track. I've got a father that has been very instrumental when we talk about integrity.
Yes.
When we talk about honesty.
Yeah.
Basic, you know, I discounted my dad early on in recovery because I thought, you know, he doesn't understand what I'm going through. But the same life skills we teach our students is what he instilled in me at a very young age.
Right.
And so as I look back on my family life, if I were to sit here and paint a picture of the perfect family that was supportive, that mm-hmm. was loving and kind, that's the family that I had.
Yeah.
But they were the reason why, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, I've had it so tough. And so, you know, it's that lens that I see my family through today versus when I was growing up. And so my dad would definitely be one of those mentors. You know, he doesn't have to be involved like he does at Red Barn. He's one of our facilitators. In fact, he teaches a mind-body bridging tonight to the students. So he's doing Stanley Block's mind-body bridging. Yeah. He's been certified in it. You know, he loves it. That's his, you know, service work. That's his spiritual experience. And that's how he is able to heal from, you know, losing a son like he did to a drug overdose.
Yeah.
You know, he goes down to the farm and he'll tell you about it. He walks out there at the farm. He has conversations with my little brother.
Yeah.
I go and have conversations with my little brother up at the cemetery. He's a big mentor to me now. I go up and see him and just talk to him and, you know, hey man, we're getting off track here. What do you think? And I wait for those impressions and those feelings. So, you know, my little brother Dustin is more alive in my life today than he ever was when he was physically here.
I love that, by the way. And that's something I learned too when I went through treatment 25 years ago or whatever, because one of the things I didn't get at the time was that the only thing that was, because I'd lost my father very young, and I didn't get that the only thing that was keeping my father out of my life, why I didn't have a relationship with him, was me.
Yeah. Too much of you on you.
Yeah, too much of me.
Yeah,
because, you know, whatever it was, for the abandonment or the attachment issues or the grief and loss I didn't want to deal with of that, and some other issues within my family system. But I, when it dawned on me, when the light went on, I was like, so I've been doing this for 30, you know, years, and all I had to do was talk to him, you know, really. And the only thing that was stopping me from having a conversation with my father was my story.
Yeah.
Yeah, again. And that was a powerful story to rewrite, and I rewrote it really quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's you know, that's been my experience. I mean, you know, I've only been really engaged in this work for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And so comparing it to, you know, my little boy, my son, you know, he's 4 months old. And, you know, I look at my students that have 4 months in the program, and there's so many parallels there. Well, being a six-year-old myself, you know, I'm still a toddler. I still have a lot to learn.
Sure.
And I think my biggest challenge today is the more time I get, the more drunk with my ego I become. I think I've got this thing figured out. And so as tough as it is to pray for humility in my life, that's what I need. Yeah. I need that uncomfortability. Yeah. I can't get complacent. I can't get overconfident. And my wife is, she's a huge help for me in that. You know, I run everything by her. She's stable. She's spiritually fit. You know, she calls me. She calls me out. I mean, I get the blinders on and she says, Mike, you're screwing up here. Mm-hmm. This is where you're falling short.
Yeah.
And she loves me enough to pull me back and give me the feedback that I don't want to hear. That yeah. some people maybe don't dare to say to me, but she's on me all the time saying, you know, this is where you're falling short.
It's great to have a partner that's willing to be honest and show up like that. Yeah.
I respect this woman and what I've put her through. We've been married, you know, for 5 years, but I've known her for 11 years now. And so she's seen the dark side of my cause. And even when my family, they may say they didn't give up on me, but when it came down to it, she was the one, my wife is the one who really, she pushed me through and she believed in me.
Yeah.
And she loved me until I've come to be able to love myself.
Love yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Next, what brings you joy? Where do you find joy in you?
Doing this.
All right.
No, honestly, so we do a pre-workout meeting at Red Barn every morning at 7 a.m. before we go off to our jobs. Uh-huh. And, you know, one of the questions the other day was, what's your dream job?
Right.
And I didn't even have to answer. I looked around at the students and said, you know what my dream job is.
Right.
I've been here for 6 years. I'm going to be here forever. I'm living the dream.
I'm living it.
Yeah. I'm absolutely living the dream. It's the most challenging, rewarding. I had no idea. I went to business school. I didn't go to become a social worker. You know, I have a master's degree in manipulation. My students have a PhD. They challenge me on a daily basis. They use my same vocabulary, vernacular. They're coming at me from all these different angles, and it really tests me. And it forces me to take a look at myself and really check where am I at spiritually? Mm-hmm. You know, where am I at with my judgments? What are really my motives with the students that I'm working with?
Right.
And it's forced me to take my personal recovery to another level. And I'm so grateful for that. Because I have to stay spiritually fit in order to do the work that I do. I had my CFO say to me the other day, he goes, Mike, he goes, isn't it such a blessing that you get to come down here to Red Barn Farms every day? And I looked at him and I said, Paul, what are you talking about? He goes, well, you get to come in here and work with all these, you know, people in recovery and share wisdom with them. I said, you're out of your mind. He says, well, what do you mean? I said, every day I walk through that door, his name's Paul too.
Yeah.
I said, every day I walk through that door, Paul.
I've met Paul, yeah.
I said, I commit spiritual suicide. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, think about it. I said, every addict that walks through the door, who do you give them to? Me. Every family member of every addict that walks through the door, who do you give them to? Me. I said, you guys suck me dry every day. So when you get a phone call from me and I'm back in uni, this would be for my third time, so I'm hoping they'll give me a discount this time. I said, that's why. I said, you drain me. Mm-hmm. And so I do have to, I've had to learn how to separate Red Barn from my personal recovery.
Right, exactly.
And, yeah, and it's big. And, you know, guys like you, that's why I'm so interested in when you go out and do your walkabouts in the desert and stuff like that. That's very, very intriguing to me because I have a lot to learn with self-care.
Well, and that's the next question, too. It leads us right into it perfectly is, you know, how do you connect? How do you find, I call it the Zen Zone. How do you connect to that within yourself so that you do feel whole and complete and, you know, you're not depleted, you know?
Right. Right. So for me right now, like I said, I'm an active member in AA. So I go to a men's group, which is really important for me. It's my home group. It's a Bountiful men's group. We meet every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. I have a service commitment there. I do believe in mentorship or sponsorship. But the other thing for me is I do spend a lot of time in the mountains. We call it trading up, right? I do these obstacle course races. I do marathons now.
Right.
I do triathlons. I'm still, you know, a little crazy. And it's nice that my wife still understands that because I could lose my mind because I can't find a place to work out or a pool to swim in. And I remind her, I said, well, at least I'm not running around town looking for drugs anymore, look for a liquor store. But I still have this crazy thinking.
Sure.
I still get restless. I still get irritable. But I would say the mountains become a big part. And I got to tell you, man, you got to come back up to the farm. These students take such good care of the farm and we have a Serenity Trail out there. And there's a lot of early mornings or late evenings. I just go out on that trail and there's an energy out there that for me, that's where I recharge my batteries.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. I will be up soon.
Thank you.
I will definitely come up soon. Okay. Let's see. What are your thoughts or what are your beliefs or ideas about God, faith, the universe?
So I'm adjusting in my chair, right? Because I'm feeling a little uncomfortable with that question, right?
Well, I mean, whatever you want to call it. I mean, the terminology doesn't really matter to me, you know, because to me, sometimes the word faith and hope, you know, connection, these all are in a way similar.
Right.
But there's sometimes people have their different beliefs about, you know, what God is or what, you know, a higher power is or what, you know, what universal energy, you know, they feel like they're part of or not.
And I love it. And I love to talk about this because I think it really does help me try to understand really where I'm at. Faith for me today is trusting the process.
Mm-hmm.
Faith for me is, you know, the love, and the compassion and the type of work that I do. And, you know, when my head hits the pillow at the end of the night, you know, I feel a sense of peace. And I know what I'm doing is worthy of, you know, of really putting all my effort and time and energy and sacrificing into it, because I'm rewarded so much more than what I put into it. You know, growing up in a religious family, you know, some of the challenges that I've had through recovery is really trying to understand and work through what type of resentments or fears, I think, is a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Fear of the unknown or, you know, fear of my own, just really where am I at based on my upbringing. I believe in energy.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in, you know, people will come out to Red Barn and sometimes they'll say, we're not exactly sure what you do here, but it has a good energy out here. I believe in a universal conscience. I believe in karma.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still working. I would say I steer clear of those individuals that say they found God. I try to align myself with the ones that are still searching.
Yeah.
I'm one of the searchers.
A seeker, yes. Which to me, I mean, I don't want to again speak for you, but to me, this idea of, you know, continuing to explore the mystery.
Exactly.
That's how I guess I feel.
And I'm intrigued with it.
Yeah.
And I see it in my students. And I love bringing a student into my office and busting their ass and they get all defensive and angry. And before they leave, I put my arm around them and I hug them and I tell them I love them. And they go from stiff as a board to they start to relax a little bit. And that energy, and when they leave my office or they leave that time that we have together and they know that they really are sincerely loved, that for me is what it's all about. And so when we talk about God and we talk about, you know, a higher power, I use the word creator. I believe that you know, you talk about getting too much of you on you. That's my problem. If I want to gauge where I'm at today with God, I look at where I'm at with my family. I look at where I'm at with my wife. I look at where I'm at with people that may get under my skin, which happens to be my family, right? They're the ones who push my buttons because they're the ones who install them, right? So if I want to test my spiritual condition, I hang out with my family. And if I'm starting to get a little restless and I'm starting to become a little judgmental, uh-huh. then I know I'm not in good spiritual stead. And I know I have.
That's a good barometer. That's a great barometer.
So
yeah.
that's what works for me. I guess at the end of the day, I hope there's a God. I believe there's a God. I just know that I'm not God.
Yeah.
And that works for me. Because when I try to play God,
right.
I get in a lot of trouble. But I'm a seeker. I like
sure.
that word.
Let's seek the mystery. And there's also this other component too that I hear a lot of people talk about that are on some kind of personal path or to explore themselves and to refine their thinking and their emotional processing. That looking at God is something less than something external. So no ego involved in this, but it's something within me authentically that I need to find a way to connect to. Yeah. That is not driven through any type of entitlement or any type of ego,
right.
but that it's part of me,
yeah.
you know, instead of something thinking it's something necessarily outside.
Yeah.
And I get that you mentioned the walkabout. So, you know, the idea of getting into the desert and walking around and connecting to nature.
Yeah.
But I really believe I connect to that. That core part of me that transcends ego and individuality so that I lose myself.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful feeling,
right.
even though getting there sometimes is a little uncomfortable. Right. I use that. I was going to say hard, but I'm going to say uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, and I love that. And I'm going to take that away with me today, and I'm going to share that with my students. But I got to tell you that, you know, you have such good energy about you from the first time that we met. And, you know, I miss our sit downs and when you would come up to Red Barn and just coming in here to your, you know, your building into your office here, the energy here is fantastic and it's palpable.
Thanks.
And it's what I want to continue to cultivate. And that's what's cool, I think, about the work that we do.
Yes.
Is we can tune into that.
Yes.
And that energy. And I do that with my students. And so I don't necessarily have to ask how they're feeling. I do it to go through the exercise, but I know the moment they walk in, I know if they're able to make eye contact
right.
with me. I know the energy that they're bringing in with them. And to be able to be in tune with that today is something that I really strive for.
Yeah, reading. You can reading someone's body is pretty quickly when you can attune to it. And and there's nothing blocking it off where you can just be vulnerable and check in with somebody. You can read them pretty quick.
Yeah.
Okay, last one. I told you I was going to ask you this question about music. So just do your best, whatever that looks like.
Fine. But it's uncomfortable. I need some uncomfortability.
Okay.
And maybe I'll get my first tattoo that says, just, you know, uncomfortable, just to remind myself, remain uncomfortable.
So the idea of if there was a song or two or something that would represent you or your life or your journey or be a life celebration for you, any songs or anything come to mind that have had an impact on you?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I grew up in the 90s, and so I grew up around the alternative scene. And so, you know, you've got the Pearl Jam and, you know, Nirvana. In fact, I went and saw Nirvana just before, you know, we lost Kurt Cobain. And so that had a huge impact on me, you know, that genre of music.
Sure. And they just had, Stone Temple Pilots, the Cult, and oh God, what was it?
Someone else.
Yeah. They were all three together like it. You saw something recently.
Right. And that's me. I mean, it's funny because my wife, she jokes around with me. She says, you know, your genre of music is the alternative, but she says, you love old house music and shitty rap. And I said, yeah, that's pretty much it. That's what sums up me. Right. So music, when I'm out, you know, doing what I need to do, it's an escape for me. So I try to be very careful because if I'm out running in the mountains, I have to make a conscious effort to take the headphones out. So I listen to the sounds and the smells because I can check out with music and it becomes a crutch for me to kind of check out. But, you know, as you ask that question, you know, a song that comes to mind is a Smashing Pumpkins song today.
Okay. Today.
Today.
I know.
Today is the greatest day.
Yeah.
And that for me is really sums up where I'm at today. Is I feel extremely blessed. I feel, you know, this journey that I'm on and this path to give back, of, you know, it's enlightened self-interest is really what it is. You know, it's a spiritual life that I'm trying to, you know, really, this path that I'm trying to stay on. And I've learned this about myself, that in order for me to get what I need to first help you get what you need. And that's the path. And so it's, I think that would be the song today. Today is the greatest day.
Today's the greatest day.
How about your
pumpkins?
How about yours?
Well, I have tons of them, to be honest with you. I've been putting together a playlist for a while.
I would love to hear that playlist.
there's a bunch of funk on it, yeah. Which I always surprise myself that yeah. they have things on it. But I add things to it when they come to me, you know, yeah. or I hear something new. I've even got some new songs on it that I added a song called Pain by The War on Drugs, which was a song that came out at the beginning, I think, of this year that just moved me. It's about, you know, it's about how pain is sort of an equalizer among yeah. human beings, that, right. you know, everyone responds to pain and,
yeah.
and are, you know, and talking about it, you know, how we respond and deal and move through our personal pain. Yeah. So, yeah, that,
I like that.
That's one. I did want to ask you one question because you brought up Proposition 2. Are you, uh-huh. And so I wondered, if we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but I just wondered generally what your thoughts are about that, because I have family members, you probably everyone does. I have a sister-in-law with MS, you know, I have another family member with Crohn's, and, you know, there another others with epilepsy and things like that. And what are your thoughts about this?
And that's a wonderful question. Typically, I probably wouldn't respond to it. You know, I wear two different hats. I wear, you know, my Red Barn hat, and then I wear my personal recovery hat. Uh-huh. You know, my personal recovery is AA, 12 steps. I don't bring 12 steps into Red Barn. I don't bring any smart recovery or any of this other stuff right. into Red Barn. And so on a personal note, based on being an opiate, you know, a recovered, I like to say past tense, opiate yes. addict. I'm no longer an opiate addict. I have some strong feelings about medication-assisted therapy. Some people will say, well, you know, you need to be more supportive of medication-assisted therapy because mm-hmm. it would have saved your little brother's life. And I said, maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't have. You know, I'm not a big fan of medication-assisted
therapy. You can
therapy.
Overdose under medication.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, they asked therapy. Me this, I was about a month ago, to come speak at a conference up in Park City about Matt. And mm-hmm. I said, I don't think you want me to come speak on that. And they said, no, we do. Come tell your story. Talk about your little brother, mm-hmm. how it would save his life. I said, no, I'm not a supporter of Matt. Mm-hmm. Personally, I know what the statistics are. I had to write plenty of papers on it. I know the benefits of it. But personally, I'm so grateful that someone did not introduce me to that when I got sober. Because mm-hmm. I'm only 6 years
old. Well, you had your own plan.
Right. But I might still yeah. be on medication-assisted therapy when it comes to medical marijuana. I'm a big proponent. Mm-hmm. When we start talking about harm reduction and we start talking about the benefits, and I think where we struggle here in our community is a lack of knowledge.
Right.
We just don't have the education. We're so quick to jump to conclusions. Mm-hmm. We're so full of fear here in our community that we just you know, brush it with a broad brush and just say, this is bad, this is good.
Right.
And we don't take the time to educate ourselves, and that's where we fall short. And I wish we did a better job yeah. understanding really what is Proposition 2.
Yeah.
What's that all about? I've seen how it has affected. I have people right now that are very, very close to me that have gotten off the opiates mm-hmm. and they're using some form
sure.
of medical marijuana. And I firmly believe, and this is my position, that if you don't support medical marijuana, you support pain pills, opiates. Right. Because what you're saying is that this over here is a better solution than this over here,
right.
which I strongly disagree
yeah.
with.
You and I are on the same page with
strongly
this,
disagree with.
By all means. And all the medical pieces, and, you know, I always it's a little bit off to the side of this, but under the same guise as people said, there's never been medical research done on marijuana. Which is, first, it's false. I mean, I did research on this, you know, a couple of years ago, because of my family,
yeah.
and so you know, I wanted to find out more about it, and it was really worth the time doing that because I realized most of the research that has been done over the last 20 years was in Israel, and Germany, and they did clinical studies and double-blind studies, and they did it all. They did, and they found out, you know, in many ways how these cannabinoid derivatives can be used in such ways to help people with medical conditions with minimal side effects.
So, I wish we would decriminalize it, because I think it's on such an individual basis that you get these special interest groups, you get whoever's, you know, paying the bills, and, you know, being a pharmaceutical sales rep, I understand the pharmaceutical industry very well. And let me just tell you, you know, being a drug rep for as long as I was, we certainly weren't interested in the well-being of the patient. You know, the drug that I sold, we did, it was just under $3 billion a year. So we did $12 million a day in sales. And we were doing anything we could to extend our patent. When I would go to these conferences and sales meetings, we never talked about the well-being of, how can we push more? How can we get doctors to write more of it? Mm-hmm. What about the long-term side effect? You know, we don't really have time to talk about that right now. We'll have someone do those studies for us. So, yeah, that's a tough one for me, because I know that we, as a community, we still have a lot to learn when it comes to that. And I wish we could remain a little bit more open-minded to that, because I'd much rather see someone using medical marijuana than putting a needle in their arms.
Sure, by all
and
means.
Using heroin.
Did you ever read the book by Johann Hari, Chasing the Scream?
No, but I've heard about it.
It's so beautifully done.
Really? So you recommend it?
I do. And I quote it a few times in my book, too. Yeah. Because he does a beautiful job of explaining how we got here. And it's really disturbing when we find out how marijuana got demonized.
Right. And that, see, I've started quite a few books like that, and I don't ever end up finishing them because they do frustrate me. Yeah. They do upset me. And I know how the story ends, and I do. I'm really trying hard to become less judgmental and opinionated when it comes to things like that. And so I try not to lend my opinion, you know, very often about that, because it brings up an energy and a feeling in me that just I don't like who I am. I mean, to be honest, I was a big time golfer for a long time. I don't play golf anymore because I don't like the way that I am when I'm on the golf course.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
People say, well, go out there and have fun. I go, I don't have fun out there. Yeah. I don't. And I don't like the guy that I become angry and upset. And, you know, it's funny. My wife said to me the other day, she says, you know what's interesting about this, Mike? She says, when you go trail running, you come back, you're in a good mood. When you go golfing, every time you come back in a bad mood. She says, why don't you do a lot more trail running and a lot less golfing? Brilliant. That's what I've done.
There you go.
And I don't like, so that energy that we talk about, I really try to distance myself from that. And I become very opinionated when we talk about, you know, the war on drugs and, you know, the opioid epidemic. And I choose to not voice my opinion because I just don't like who I am.
Yeah, I got you. Well, I appreciate you sharing a little bit of that here today.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I do recommend checking out that book. He's got another book, though, too, on depression and anxiety.
I've heard that. Someone told me, because I recognize the author's name.
It's called Lost Connections.
Lost Connections. And I would be more interested in that book.
And what's beautiful about that is that it's all about taking personal accountability.
Yeah.
And how that's been, how we create our own, again, based upon our story.
Right.
How we've taken on how we need to take on responsibility for our own levels of anxiety and depressive states that we
You're create. An avid reader. Aren't you?
I do read a
That's
lot.
Awesome. Yeah. I need to be better with that.
I have my moments. I come and go.
Do you go read when you're out in the desert at all?
I did. In fact, I was reading Michael Pollan's new book, Change the Mind.
Oh, okay.
How to Change Your Mind on this one.
So before we end then, what would you say? Because for me, you know, I'm always looking for kind of the latest and greatest ideas and, you know, examples. When we start to really dive into changing behaviors. What have you read recently that's really kind of made an impact on you that you bring in to your IOP or your family group? Is there some recent aha moments you've had?
Well, I to be honest with you, I took a lot of those and I put them in my book. But I'm going to recommend you do that, read that. But one of the most powerful experiences I've had was reading The Biology of Desire.
Oh, wow. And
why can't I remember his name?
That sounds very deep.
Yeah, it's actually a light, pretty much a light, it's a much lighter book than it sounds.
Okay.
But it explains why addiction is not a disease.
Okay.
And
I like that.
Yeah. That's the subtitle, Why Addiction is Not a Disease.
Okay.
And he does a beautiful job of it. He explains it more from the sense of, you know, the neurological conditioning and feedback loops and schemas and how we can create all those. And then talks about, and he applies it to all different aspects of mental health, which is, I think, a really reachable and simple way that most people relate to. And that's what I like about the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So after this, I'm going to send you an email and I need to get a list of some of these books I need to be reading.
I'll do that. Mike, thanks so much. I really appreciate you coming out today and spending the afternoon with us, especially after I had clients this morning, but you were down at Recovery Days. So I know there's a couple more coming up. Isn't there one up in
Yeah, so Davis? They usually do, they'll do Weber County, they'll do Utah County, and then I think they go down and do Washington County.
Yeah.
So, you know, September is National Recovery Month. And those are usually the big ones here in Utah. So,
and we do have a great organization, USARA, who really does amazing work in the community.
Yeah, so. Mary Jo, I'm a big fan of Mary Jo and her husband Sean, who runs First Step House. I think they're the powerhouse couple here in Utah when it comes to recovery.
Definitely the powerhouse couple here in recovery for Utah.
Together, they have close to 70 years in recovery. And so, yeah, she's been a blessing in my life, especially. So when Mary Jo was ordering me around today out at Recovery Day, and I do whatever she asks me to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, she asks me to jump. I say, okay, Mary Jo, how high, how many times?
right.
So, yeah, we do. We have a wonderful recovery community. I think our treatment centers here are amazing. We're very, very blessed, I think, in this community to offer the services and all the wraparound services that we offer and all the different types of recovery. You know, you were talking about refugee.
Is that refuge recovery.
Recovery. Yeah. I mean, and I look at some of the different paths, and that's what I love about even USARA's mission statement is that, you know, they support everyone's individual path of recovery.
Yeah.
I love that. And I think if we could take that and apply that to other aspects of our lives, I think we would all be better off.
Learning different languages in this community is important. Yeah. I talk about this in my book a lot, but it's like learning to be able to speak other languages in recovery is as important as anything else. Yeah. Because when we don't, we have a tendency, I shouldn't say I do, then I have a tendency to become discriminatory towards a different belief system, and that doesn't help anybody.
Right. Even ignorant. Like I did that early on in recovery because I had lacked, you know, really the experience or the knowledge. You know, when I first got sober, I thought, oh, AA 12 steps is the only way. You know, I was very, very short-sighted, right?
Right.
It worked for me at the time, but thank goodness my recovery today is dynamic and changing. And I hope that I'm, you know, further along, you know, down the road than where I'm at today. Because if not, then it's not going to work.
Well, the studies, you know, the studies, you asked me about a book. The reason why I really recommend Chasing the Scream is because they have all the research, all the Rat Park research in there. And he does the
That's about the human connection piece, right?
Which is if people learn to develop healthy, vulnerable, intimate connections with people, that is sustainable.
Yes, exactly. And I believe that. Because that's where I'm at today.
Yeah.
I had no idea that, you know, I thought it was just about not drinking, not using drugs. I had no idea that I would be able to connect on this level that I am with my wife, with my parents, with my family members.
Right.
And that's what sustains me today. And cultivating that is, I didn't realize that when I first got sober.
Yeah. There's the key. All right. We thank you all for spending this afternoon with us. Next week, David Frasconi will be my guest. And the week after, maybe Jake Forsyth from Willowtree. I'm not sure about that one. We'll see what happens. Anyway, thank you again for joining us. Thanks, Mike. You have a good weekend. And we'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Just a stranger. What would it look like, and would you want to see if seeing meant that you would have to be